Almost on a daily basis, we hear stories about people losing jobs in their homes, struggling to take care of themselves and their children. Even people who are managing to pay the bills today, they are worried about tomorrow. Challenges like these can actually bring families closer together, but as we know, they can also tear them apart. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll talk a little bit about the effects of America's current economic ills on families. And we have two guests, and both of them are people with a lot of experience thinking about and talking about families and about marriages. And our two guests are Dr. Joshua Coleman and Stephanie Kuntz. And let me tell you a little bit more about the two of them. Joshua Coleman is a psychologist in private practice with offices in San Francisco and Oakland, California. He's also a senior fellow with the Council on Contemporary Families. He served on the clinical faculties of University of California at San Francisco, the Wright Institute Graduate School of Psychology, the San Francisco Psychotherapy Research. He's the author of four books, just to mention two titles, The Marriage Makeover, Finding Happiness in Imperfect Harmony, and When Parents Hurt, Compassionate Strategies When You and Your Grown Child Don't Get Along. Stephanie Kuntz teaches history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She is director of research and public education for the Council on Contemporary Families, and she has authored a number of books about the history of the family, and her most recent is Marriage, A History, From Obedience to Intimacy, or How Love Conquered Marriage, published by the Viking Press. She has also testified about her research before the House Select Committee on Children, Youth, and Families in Washington, and has done a lot of speaking and a lot of interviewing truly around the world, and really both of them have. I'm glad to have both of them joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana and toll free 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions, comments are certainly welcome. Dr. Coleman, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
And Professor Kuntz, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. It's always a pleasure.
Well, as a way of starting, I guess, maybe I'll ask Stephanie Kuntz, as someone who is an historian of the family and has spent a lot of time thinking about and writing about families in America, really going back a long way. Certainly, families all along that timeline have faced challenges, but it seems to be the case that for people today, probably people who are alive today, it's simply the kind of challenges that we're seeing now, they've just never seen that. I'm not sure that any of us, not having lived through the Depression, have seen really anything like this before.
That's right. You know, that's one of the downsides of having had a prolonged boom after World War II. I'm just old enough to remember my parents' stories of the Depression, and it shaped me in ways that I think that, you know, I'm 64 now, that a younger the people younger than me simply never were shaped by. One of the things that we know historically is that the Great Depression was just a tremendous problem for people. But I think the kind of problems that people have today are a little different. First of all, because they do have that expectation, especially in the middle class, that things will go upward. And in the working class, which has actually been struggling for the past 20 years, quite a bit, real wages have been falling. Nevertheless, the sense of hope, the sense that you were going to be able to send your kids to college, that you might be able to do better. In the last period, this tremendous, tremendous winner-take-all economy and the pressure even on affluent people of thinking that they were falling behind and somehow that they had to accelerate what they gave their kids, the chances they gave their kids, all these things have been called into question by this tremendous economic crash. And it comes as a shock to many people. Both to people who were poor but who were thinking that probably they could scrape up enough to send their kids to college and get them to head, but also to people who, middling income folks who were used to buying lunch out and being able to stop at Starbucks and suddenly see themselves having to cut back in so many different ways, including worrying about whether they're going to lose their home, lose their job, lose their medical insurance. So, you know, I think that some of the fallout will be similar in terms of family stress, but I think that some will be quite different.
Mm. Well, maybe I'll turn to Dr. Coleman, and maybe you can cite some personal experience, since you're someone who does therapy, does counseling. What sort of things have you seen, and have you seen signs of family stress that you can say directly have to do with the kinds of things that Dr. Koontz was just talking about?
Well, you know, we know from research that one of the big things couples fight about, even in periods of non-economic stress, is money. It's one of the top things that couples argue about. So now they have a really good reason to argue about it and worry about it. And severe economic downturns are associated with increased risk of divorce, harsher parenting techniques, increased chance of depression on both parts of the parents. So the amount of pressure that these kind of downturns can exert on the family are enormous. And I do see that in the people that I work with and in the families of the people that I work with. It does have a very big toll on the families that I'm seeing, and does it in many of them is increasing the strain.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you point out the fact that I think one of the things that we know is, if you look at the various stressors that can come to bear on a marriage, whether people have children or not, that money is high on the list. That's of all the things that causes people right. to fight and have disagreements, money, things like either whether you don't have enough. I mean, do we have enough? Are we managing to pay the bills? Or it could be something also like just priorities, you know, arguing over not do we have enough money, but what it is that we spend our money on. We know in relationships one of the things
exactly.
that's top on the list of sources of conflict, right?
Yeah, absolutely. When people do have money, do we spend it on ourselves or our children? Do we put it into the house? Do we save it? Do we, you know, what kind of a lifestyle do we lead? So, and it's very tied to personal values in a whole complex of ways. But when there's very little, then it gets into more primitive, primary kinds of anxieties. Are we going to survive? Are we going to lose our status, you know, or are we going to even have a home? And that is when you really begin to see very powerful effects on the family.
Yeah. And I wonder whether there might be, in the case of where we are now, families who maybe, because they were doing okay before, maybe they didn't really talk that much about money. Maybe they really didn't have to. The bills got paid, and they had some discretionary spending, so they could spend money on things that they maybe wanted but didn't really need. And that now people are actually having to have conversations about how money gets spent that they actually never had before.
I think that's exactly right. And so you're seeing families that are having to adapt to a situation that in some ways they don't have very much preparation for. Mm-hmm. And I think in general, in the same way that you see the way a family manage any kind of severe stress, say a child who has an illness or the death of a parent or some other kind of surprising incident, families that have close, good communication, have resiliency in the marriage, among the family, good communication, those families tend to do better than families where there's already ongoing marital conflict, where there's families, you know, are on the edge of divorce, or there's severe disagreements, or there are other kinds of issues, alcoholism, et cetera. So you know, that's one way to think about it.
Hmm. Can I just add something?
Yes, sir, please do.
Another thing, because Joshua talked about the question of how parenting is affected, and one of the things that we see in marriages that is really important is that, kids can put up with a certain amount of economic deprivation, and in fact, I think that parents would be surprised at how few toys a kid actually needs to be happy.
Yeah.
But one of the things that is really hard on kids is that when parents are under economic stress, even if they're not actually fighting, they tend to forget to do the sorts of daily exchanges, either with each other or with their kids, where you validate what some researchers call an economy of gratitude, where you validate what the other person does that you appreciate. Instead, under stress, you only begin to notice what they're doing that adds to your stress. So with couples, it may be that you only really interact when you're angry or when you need to solve something, and you miss those sort of positive exchanges that keep a marriage going. And with kids, one of the things that researchers find is that the parents stop noticing when the kids are being good and only notice when the kids are being bad. So they only start to respond in negative ways. And that's something that all of us, even couples with really good relationships, need to be careful about in times like this.
I think Stephanie's raising a hugely important point. You know, in parenting advice, we talk about catch your child doing something right if you're trying to motivate them to change your behavior. Well, it's also true in marriage and in all family relationships. And it's very true that when couples are stressed out, whether it's for financial or other reasons, that they really do just stop seeing the positive. And the single best thing you can do for your marriage, particularly during times like this, is to talk about what you still value and love and admire and respect in your partner, not only because it will make them feel better, but it'll also make you feel better to say it and to pay attention to those things.
Let me just very quickly introduce our two guests for anybody who might have just tuned in. Joshua Coleman is a psychologist in private practice with offices in San Francisco and Oakland, California. He's also a senior fellow with the Council on Contemporary Families, has written several books about marriage. Stephanie Kuntz is very well known as an historian of the family. She teaches history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She's director of research and public education for the Council on Contemporary Families and has authored a number of books about family in America. We're trying to talk a little bit about issues that affect family life and produce stress in difficult financial times like those that we are going through now. And questions and comments are certainly welcome from people who are listening. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. It's something that both of you can comment on, I'm sure. Maybe I'll turn again to Stephanie Kuntz first and then to Joshua Coleman. One of the things that I know that people who do research on the family have been looking at now for some time is something that's sometimes called resiliency. And essentially, they're looking at this question, why is it that some people manage to come through very difficult, stressful times okay, and some families manage to do all right, and some don't? Now, what really is it that makes the difference between the two? I don't know if we have very good answers to those questions or not, but I'll just put that question out there. Do we have some idea what it is about some families that helps them better weather really tough times?
Mm-hmm. Well, Joshua can probably add more than I can to this, but I do know some of the research. And one of the things that's really sad about tough times is that it tends to undermine protective strategies that people who started with tough times have developed. So in a sense, if you were a kid who grew up in a very difficult family or with a lot of economic stress, personal stress, some dysfunctional stuff, if you've had a decent life, you've been able to develop a lot of protective factors, and you may be just doing fine as long as you don't get just hammered with stress. And so one of the things that we think is really sad about these kind of economic crises is that it tends to undo the work that people have done in making up for difficult childhoods and trigger some of those early childhood things. Yeah. We know that resilience, some of the important things that are vital in resilience are not just good family ties, but good social support networks, people who have had mentors in their past. All of these things can make a big difference in resiliency. Another thing that I think might be very important in this particular economic climate, and perhaps could be some good news compared to, say, the Great Depression, is that during the Great Depression, gender roles were extremely inflexible. You know, I mean, the idea was that women should stay home. You weren't a success as a man unless you could support your family entirely. And the male unemployment, people tend to interpret this in the 1930s as a failure of masculinity rather than as a failure of the system. And it led to all sorts. It led to a huge increase in domestic violence, and it led also to all sorts of hostility toward women. Well, in this recession, 82% of the job losses have been to men. But in many cases, those women, the wives in those families are already working, and they are going to become the main breadwinner of the family. So there's a lot of debate among researchers about whether the men will react to this by not stepping up to the plate at home, whether the women will feel that they're being failed. And I think, of course, that that is a possibility, but I also think we have one thing going for us now, and that is a higher respect for men's role at home and for women's role at work, so that we're going to be a little more flexible responding to these challenges than perhaps we were in the 1930s.
Hmm. Well, anything you'd like to add to that or maybe take it in a slightly different direction, Dr. Coleman?
No, I thought that was extremely important. I guess the only thing I would add is that we still live in a highly, and I know Stephanie wouldn't disagree with this, that we live in a highly individualistic culture. And the problem with an individualistic culture is that it's very shaming when there is some kind of an economic downturn. When you lose a job, it's hard enough, but you live in a society which creates the feeling that your successes and your failures are really because of your own very personal qualities. There isn't much room to protect the self-esteem. So one of the reasons that we see increases in depression, alcoholism, sometimes suicidality, family dissolution, is because the temptation to attack the self with the loss of a job, because it's this fundamental shift in identity, is so severe that there's really no insulation against that. So to get back to your question about what can create resiliency, well, ideally families are interconnected with other families, but one of the things that we've seen in the past few decades has been a huge transfer in emotional resources away from neighborhoods, extended kin, religious institutions, and it's all been kind of sucked up into the nuclear family. Mm-hmm. So we've become actually more and more isolated. And one of the things that really protects people and makes them more resilient is extended family and close social relationships and the ability to lean on other people and to talk to other people and to feel like, okay, I'm not in this alone. So one of my recommendations to families who are going through this is to really reach out to the people that you're closest to, do volunteer work, do anything that connects you with society. Do not isolate.
Just to go for a second to go back to the earlier point that you made that relates to this idea that people identify so strongly themselves with their work and their sense of worth with their work. We know that I'm sure that there are a lot of people across the country who have ended up losing their jobs, and it wasn't because they were doing a bad job.
Exactly.
It wasn't that the boss came to them and said, you're a worthless employee. I don't want you here anymore. That was not the case.
Right.
But given that, I mean, even though people know that, they may know that it wasn't their fault. It wasn't because they were doing a bad job. What do you say to someone, though, who feels that sense of worthlessness and somehow feels it was their fault, even though maybe one part of their head they can say, no, this wasn't because of me.
Well, it's the big advance in psychology is cognitive therapy, and that's helping people understand the way that their beliefs and the way that the kind of ongoing dialogue that people have with themselves, how that affects their mood and their self-esteem. So if I'm working with somebody in a very detailed way, I'll actually have them write out their thought processes and understand how their beliefs are actually affecting their mood, and then help them to develop ideas that actually go against that. So we'd look at the rationality, the irrationality of those beliefs, and have them develop a very different kind of inner dialogue to address those feelings.
You know, one of the things that I think helps me most personally about being a historian is that often I can step back from a difficult situation and say to myself, this is not my fault or my partner's fault.
Uh-huh.
This is because there have been social and economic changes that create new dilemmas. And I think that's something very important for people to do in a period like this. Step back and actually read some of the ways that we got here instead of, the hysterical stuff you hear on the news about what individual can we blame. Look at the kind of errors we've made as a society.
Uh-huh.
And learn that this is something that is structural and systemic and that we can change. I mean, we did change it after the Great Depression. And I think, ironically, that one of the silver linings to it being this bad compared to, say, 20 years ago in the 80s, when you had a lot of economic insecurity, but there was still a sense that the economy was growing, and it was easier to think of it as people's failures, either my failure if I lost it or your failure if you lost a job. Now you can look around and you really realize that, hey, we are all in the same boat here. Some people maybe have bigger boats, but it turns out that we're subject to the same winds and tides. And the more you can understand that, I think the more you can help people channel their discomfort, their anger, their disappointment in a more constructive direction than blaming themselves or their partners or looking for scapegoats. You know, let's actually analyze this, how this happened, and see if we can come out of this the way we came out of the Depression, with a sense that this is not a society in which you win or lose just by your own efforts, that we all need to work together and to build and invest in the kinds of social support systems and infrastructure that can make us all grow together the way we did in the period from 1949 to 1973.
All right.
Or
well,
we forgot that.
Yeah. We have a caller here. Why don't we bring them into the conversation? Someone here where we are, here in Champaign County. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi. That sort of leads to this question in a way, though I was already trying to formulate it, and I apologize. I haven't done the best job, but putting aside the exigencies of the moment, this crash, so there are some parts of the culture have already been, you know, in a depression, inner cities I'm thinking of. Different periods of time, there have been, you know, various dislocations of family structure. And in fact, I wanted to know if either you were sympathetic to the idea that the family as the norm is a bit of a distortion. I mean, I'm not talking about contemporary examples of differently defined families, but, you know, there was child labor in the Industrial Revolution and even in the 20s in this country, and there wasn't much of a family happening then. There was massive disruption of family. But I mean, even in a stable, more stable structure, there's still, we're always different kinds of networks, domestics, immigrants came in and indentured as domestics. Slaves, of course, were domestics. After Jim Crow era, there's more than a bit of the myth of the Golden Age going on here. If I could get you to address that, if that's clear enough.
Well, that's certainly something Professor Koontz, I think, would have something to say about.
Absolutely. There has been this sense that has arisen in the last 20 or 30 years, along with this increase in individualism that Josh was talking about, that somehow families can do it alone, should do it alone, they always have done alone. If they fail to do it, it's their own fault. And what you say is completely true. There's never been a golden age of family life. And families have always had challenges, and one of the strengths of families in the past has been when they recognized that they couldn't just go it alone. You know, we came out, as you say, there was child labor. It wasn't abolished until the 1930s. In the 1950s, supposedly the golden age of American families, far fewer kids graduated from high school. There were much bigger high school dropout rates. They were more likely to drive drunk, teenagers were in the 50s, than they are today. It was a good time to have a family if you had, your mother wasn't an alcoholic, your father wasn't an abuser, and you had one of those union jobs or those expanding middle-class jobs and the tremendous government support systems for young families just starting out that you had in the 50s. And so one of the things we have to understand now is that in the absence of these support systems, the nuclear family or even the extended family cannot do it alone. One of the things that I feel about, you know, I've listened and studied the problems in the inner cities over the past 20 years, and so many middle-class Americans say, what's wrong with those families? You know, what's wrong with a community that can't get its graffiti under control? Well, now this is happening in middle-class neighborhoods where you get foreclosures, abandonments, the grass grows, drug dealers move in, graffiti, the same problems in these middle-class neighborhoods that some people used to think were just problems in the family values or family structures of those families living in inner-city neighbors. So I guess what I'm saying is just agreeing with you strongly that families cannot do it alone, they go it alone. They've never have been able to. We have to recognize our need for social support systems.
I would inquire if you would even go further, because part of what I'm trying to get at is the idea that I think social policy shouldn't define itself as simply supporting a new golden age of families and just accept the fact that different people are going to live in different ways, and we need a social policy that doesn't discriminate against people who are single, for instance, I'll say.
Well, that's
because we're in a community here that has a high percentage of single adults who apparently like it that way or like something else less well. So I just think that, you know, there's so much discourse that goes around, you know, elevating the family when, you know, it isn't everyone's cup of tea. I have a visual image of Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera for some reason in my head, who had houses that were completely separate except a walkway between the two. I'm digressing here, but I just want to emphasize the point that.
Well, let me say one thing that supports this point from the point of view of looking at family values. And it seems to me that core family values are that we want kids to grow up safe. We want elders to be taken care of. It's not just married couples who do that. Actually, a recent study by two sociologists found that today single individuals spend more time taking care of elderly parents and giving support to friends and extended kin and neighbors and coworkers than married couples do, who are so wrapped up in their own nuclear family. So just because someone isn't living in a family doesn't mean they aren't doing the family-friendly services of building a community.
All right. Well, I thank the caller for the comments. I would like to invite anybody else who's listening to join in. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have two guests with us joining us by telephone. Stephanie Kuntz, she teaches history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She's director of research and public education for the Council on Contemporary Families, has written a number of books about the history of the family. Her most recent is Marriage, A History from Obedience to Intimacy, or How Love Conquered Marriage, published by the Viking Press in 2005. Also joining us is Dr. Joshua Coleman. He's a psychologist in private practice with offices in both San Francisco and Oakland, California. He is a senior fellow with the Council on Contemporary Families, has authored a number of books himself, including The Marriage Makeover, Finding Happiness in Imperfect Harmony, and When Parents Hurt, Compassionate Strategies When You and Your Grown Child Don't Get Along. And we're talking about some of the stresses that come to bear on families today, particularly because of the difficult economic times that folks are living through. And questions are welcome. I want to turn to Joshua Coleman. It seems to me that one of the challenges for families is going to be if there's a lot of upheaval, if parents have lost jobs, if people have lost their homes, they may be having to move. Some cases, children, if that movement's going on, they may be changing schools. It seems that there can be an awful lot of disruption and uncertainty, and it seems to me that perhaps the challenge here for families, and particularly for children, is for parents, is to find some source of stability somewhere. You know, find something to hang on that has not changed.
Yeah, I think that's actually a good point, that stability and predictability are the key watchwords for children in terms of predicting their happiness and well-being. The more children know how things are going to go and the more stable and consistent they are, particularly if they're consistently, you know, somewhat positive, they don't have to be perfect by any means, but children have a fundamental need to know what's going to happen. So if there's going to be a move, then as soon as you know, and as soon as you have the details, the more you can let them know, the better. The more you can tell them in a relaxed way, the better. But the more you can kind of keep consistent some of the family rituals, the better it will go as well. So in other words, the more that you can preserve what was good and stable about the family, the better things are going to go. And this goes back to an earlier point that both Steph and I were making about the importance of staying in touch with what's positive and good in the family. It's very easy for families, when there is an enormous upheaval like that, for this to become the sole thing that the family talks about, and families can become extremely preoccupied with it because it's all-encompassing. But I think families do best when they can really isolate the amount of time that the crisis gets talked about, continue to do the things that are pleasurable, continue to focus on the things that are good and healthy in the family. Those are some of the most important things that families can do for both the children and the other members involved.
Can I ask Josh a question? You're not saying, though, that families should try to protect their kids from knowledge of this sort of problem, are you?
No, not at all. No, I actually think it's useful for children to know, particularly because of what I think is useful for parents to do if they are being more irritable, which probably most are, because they're more stressed out, they're more anxious, they might be depressed, they might be terrified. It's useful for children to hear, look, you know, I am more irritable lately. I am going to be a little more reactive. I did lose my job, but at the same time, a parent should be reassuring. You know, I will get another job. I don't want you to worry. But if I seem a little more irritable lately, that's the reason. To help children understand what the reason is that there's been a shift in your behavior. Otherwise, children will personalize it.
I think that that's a really good point, because I would expect that there might be some parents who would think that the best thing to do, they would think, I don't want the kids to worry.
Right.
I don't want the kids to worry about where their next meal is coming from. I don't want them to worry about, are they going to have a roof over their heads? You know, they got enough stuff to worry about. And so that parents might tend to say, talk about that in hushed and worried tones between themselves, but they might be tempted to think, well, we're not going to give this burden also to the children, and that probably is a mistake.
No, that's right. The children, children are perceptive. They know something's wrong, but if they don't hear it, then they're going to think that it's something that they've done. So if you are using harsher parenting techniques, first of all, you want to apologize to your child if you were harsh to them, if you have changed your parenting because you are upset. But you also want to explain the reason so that they can write it off. That provides a certain amount of insulation for children.
Can I just add something to that?
Mm-hmm.
From both sociological and psychological research and from historical experience, you know, kids do better when they actually know what the issues are. They don't have to know them in the most detail. As Joshua said, they do notice things. When outside observers observe a marriage and they code it themselves, you know, as low conflict but distant or contemptuous, but then they go and they ask the kids will tell them it's a high-conflict marriage. So kids pick up on these undercurrents, and they need to be brought out in the open so that the kids don't think they're worse than they actually are. And, you know, when we look back at the past of what kids have lived through and even thrived under, to the extent that you can involve kids in the family challenges, not overwhelming them, but letting them know that they can be part of an effort to solve this or contain it, that's very healthy for kids.
Well, I think that's also a good point, and then leads to the question, and again here maybe I'll turn back to Joshua Coleman. Well, how do you do that? Do you have some suggestions on how people do that?
How they talk to their children about it?
Particularly do what Stephanie Kuntz said, maybe not only talk to them about it, but somehow involve them, make it possible to feel that they actually have some sort of role, some sort of productive role to play, or at least that they're able to contribute ideas and thoughts, and, you know, they're a participant in the whole thing.
Well, depending on the age of the child, I mean, you could have them be involved with you in terms of a job search. I mean, teenagers are very sophisticated with the Internet. You could have them help with a job search around the Internet, collecting information. I mean, it could be part of a family project. The main thing is that it be involved in some kind of a cohesive way so that the child feels like, oh, this is something that we're all doing together. And it can also give the child a sense of efficacy to feel like, oh, I'm actually helping here. You know, I'm a contributing. I can actually help my parents. You know, there's research on depressed parents. It's mostly on mothers, unfortunately, but I'm sure it's true of fathers who are the primary parent. And what they found is that people who are raised by depressed mothers have their own depression and their own struggles. And one of the theories is that it's because the children don't really feel effective. They don't feel like they can cheer up the parent. They don't feel like they can give them pleasure. And so we know that one of the things that really matters to children is the feeling that they can really impact the parent. So the more that parents can certainly not make the kid feel responsible for it, but if they can make them feel like this is a family project, that could actually be useful for children.
That can be in ways. I remember just personally that when my dad went back to school on the GI Bill, and we were broke as a very early age. My parents said to me, you know, we're going to have to save money. We're going to have to do, you know, and I was, it wasn't like, oh, we're going to starve to death, but it was, what can we do? And I had little, you know, ideas as a 4 or 5 year old, they tell me. And I think it was a very empowering experience.
Right. Yeah, it becomes part of a family project. And I think what Stephanie said earlier is really important to highlight. We live in a culture that makes parents feel like they're being neglectful if they don't give their children the latest and greatest gadget and toy that the other kids have. Well, actually, children don't really care that much, even if they protest loudly and make you feel like you're a neglectful parent. What really matters to children is close relationships with their parents and their parents' involvement with them. So you're much better off not feeling guilty about giving your children things and having a conversation with them. If this is now a family project of conserving money, you know, we'll hopefully get to a point soon where we don't have to worry as much, but right now we do, not making it a big deal, but being clear about what the details are. That's far better from them than you're feeling guilty because you can't give them the latest, greatest thing that they don't really need anyway.
If you, I mean, you'd like to think that parents would be tuned into their kids' emotions and know what was going on with them and whether they were happy or they're sad. But I wonder whether in a time like this, it's even more important for parents to be as much as they possibly can paying attention to what sort of little signs that children might give to show that they're going through emotional distress.
Yeah, and I think it's that's why I want parents to, you know, both be forgiving of themselves if they do feel a lapse in their parenting. I mean, if I'm stressed out, I'm a psychologist, if I'm stressed out and exhausted, my parenting definitely suffers. I'm more irritable. I'm more short-tempered. But what matters to kids is you're going back. It's the same as with a relationship. You know, if you blow it with your partner, you say something stupid or thoughtless or mean, to go back and say, you know, I'm really sorry, you didn't deserve that. Like in the parent, you know, I'm very stressed out right now about the, you know, about losing my job. You know, I'm really sorry. I was so irritable with you. To make a repair attempt in terms of what was done, or if you see the child looking really preoccupied and worried, you could ask them. But children will usually tell you what they're thinking. So if you are noticing a change in your child's behavior, to check in with them about it.
I'm interested in going back here to Stephanie Kuntz, and again, based on the fact that you've spent a lot of time thinking about the family and also about gender roles, relations between men and women, we like to think that in the last few decades, things have changed, and they have, and you know, one shouldn't minimize the amount of change. And yet sometimes if you forgive the cliche, it's like the more things change, the more they stay the same. What I'm just curious, in the long term, something like this, do you think that it's likely to have some sort of additional significant, it will be a significant force of change in these kinds of things?
Well, that's the big question. You know, in some ways, this is a great big social experiment that would be absolutely fascinating if we weren't also so concerned about the human pain of it. What happened in the Great Depression was that this experience of male job loss and the kind of sense that women were taking men's job, which they weren't. They were taking lower-paid jobs, but men were still feeling like they were being neglected. This led to a whole family dynamic whereby women working was associated with economic stress, with family tension, and children who were raised in the Great Depression ended up having more of a sense that they ought to have traditional gender roles and that it was wrong for men to do work at home and for women to do work outside the home than actually the previous generation had. And sometimes when men got unemployed, very often when men were unemployed, they would refuse to help out around the house or with the kids because they would see that as a further emasculation of them. And so they would try to compensate for their sense of emasculation in the job by saying, okay, I'm going to insist upon my privileges in the home. And some people are very frightened that this is going to happen this time. I think it may, in some cases, particularly among people with more old-fashioned, more traditional gender roles. But I'm also kind of optimistic that in the last 10 or 15 years, There's more respect for women working. There's also more of a sense that men do have something to contribute at home and that it's not a step downward to be able to spend time with your kids. So it's going to be very interesting to see what comes out of this. Mm. If people draw the lessons that, gender flexibility is actually a protection for families and something that we should continue to foster and nurture, or if some people want to go backwards.
Mm. Just
I think that's a good point that Stephanie raises. There was a study done by sociologist Scott Coltrane and Rory O'Sullivan, and they found that in the past four decades, men have tripled the amount of child care that they've done, and they've also doubled the amount of housework. So in many ways, men have changed in ways that hopefully will make them more resilient and more better able to make this transition than they had in prior generations. And I think, as Stephanie highlights, I think men in particular as fathers are much more identified in taking much more pleasure in the fathering role. So the idea of being at home with the kids, that were my father's generation may have been, you know, some form of hell. For many of today's fathers, it may be a much more pleasurable thing, and it may not have the same kind of identity cost that it did in prior generations.
Hmm. Let's talk with another caller, someone in Oakland, line number one right here. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. One of your previous callers, I sort of got the impression that he was trying to address the concept of the Norman Rockwell mythical family vision of, you know, one man, one woman, and the 2.2 kids, and as opposed to the family structure that we have today, which could be one woman and kids, or a man and kids, or two men or two women and kids, or, you know, grandparents and kids, that the whole picture of family structure has changed. But it was also sort of a myth in the Norman Rockwell picture sense of what a family constituted.
Well, Professor Kuntz, you want to respond to that?
Well, yes. I think that's true. That's what he was trying to, the point he was trying to make, and that you're reinforcing here. We have this idea that somehow, if we, you know, for the past 20, 30 years, some people have been telling us that we could get rid of all of the problems that were bubbling up in this overly individualistic, winner-take-all, destroy the social safety net economy that we've had for the past 20 or 30 years. We've had people telling us that we wouldn't have any of these problems, that nothing would go wrong if everybody would just live like Ozzie and Harriet lived on those TV sitcoms. And the fact is that through most of history, there was much more diversity in families because of death rates, because of extended kin living together. There were more single parents in the 19th century than there are even today. And yet people managed to function. And when we look back at that 1950s family and scratch the surface of it, we find that there were all sorts of issues hidden behind it, that the successes of that era had more to do with the fact that this was an era when the government was being very generous, not about supporting families like giving out welfare, but giving out incentives that help families grow, investing in infrastructure. You know, the government invested three times as much in job creation programs during the 50s as it has invested over the past 20 years. So these kinds of things were much more important than the actual family form. And many families that looked fine from the outside and even were beneficiaries of this help were still problems. This was a period when alcoholism, when tranquilizer abuse by unhappy women, much higher rates of domestic violence than we have today, of child abuse than we have today. So there, you can't just look at one family from the outside and say, that family's going to be perfect, and if you would live like that, that would solve all our problems.
Great. Thank you.
Right. And I think that we do, as a society, have to support all forms of families, single parents, gay and lesbian couples, single mothers by choice. And I think the more incorporative we are of the rich diversity of family life, the healthier we're going to be and the more resilient we're going to be as a society.
Yeah. Certainly, it's worth making the point, maybe we're belaboring the point, but that the kind of prosperity we saw in the immediate post-war period was unusual in American history for a variety of reasons, and certainly the conditions that made it possible for one individual with their labor to support the family, that was an anomaly. And we're probably never going to see that again. And in fact, probably in the period before that, we really didn't see it.
That's correct. I think that we can come closer to it if we go back to the sense that you don't have to, you know, that there doesn't have to be this constant acceleration of wealth getting, that there is a sort of happy medium for people, which I think people did have in the 1950s. But I think it's also true, you're absolutely right, that the 1950s also had these much higher poverty rates for African Americans, for rural families. And we also were the only country to emerge from World War II with our infrastructure intact. And in a sense, we were able to profit from the misery of the rest of the country, the rest of the world, in a way that we can no longer do today. We no longer have that unparalleled place in the world economy. We've got competitors rising. We've got people who are competing with us to use up the natural resources. So we're going to have to rethink all of our policies instead of just think that we can recapture that golden era.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that there are things in the past, and particularly from that period, we can draw on. And that is the sense that there might be some ways in which we can foster a situation where people don't get rewarded for speculation, where corporations instead get rewarded for maintaining their jobs in the same place and for building communities, and where we invest in long-term infrastructure and job creation and, of course, in today's world, energy saving.
We're coming down to the point we have a couple of minutes left, and I'm interested in asking a kind of a speculative question. We touched on it a little bit, and it may be more along Stephanie Kuntz's line than Joshua Coleman's, but let me start with Joshua Coleman and pose the question. I'm just interested in what you might say. I certainly think that everyone hopes that things will start turning around maybe by the end of the year, and that the time we're going through now, while it's a very serious recession, is not going to be as bad as the Great Depression. But having said that, I think one of the things we know about the Depression is that for the people who lived through it, it forever after shaped their way of thinking and their worldview. It left its mark on them. And I wonder whether you think that the kind of psychological stresses that come with the difficult times that we're going through now could have that kind of effect on people.
Well, I mean, I suspect it would have to last longer for it to have that kind of effect on people. The Depression lasted, I don't know exactly how long, Stephanie would know, but I think it would have to last longer for it to have the kind of profound identity-changing effect that we saw from our parents. But I think anybody who has lost a job or has lost their savings, I think that kind of thing does leave a big mark on people and does cause them to rethink their priorities and how they save and how they think about even government. I mean, we're certainly seeing a sea change in how we think about government and the government's role and what has to be regulated and what doesn't have to be regulated. Hopefully, as Stephanie has stressed and written about so eloquently, the importance of government intervention in infrastructure and the power that has on the family, that the family can't stand alone. That is certainly my wish, that if there's any silver lining in all of this, there's going to be a great cultural insight in our society about the need for government investment, financial investment in the family as it did in the 50s and at other times to really protect the family.
Mm. First,
I would have to say that you might want to take this with a little grain of salt, because as I told my husband a couple months ago, I've predicted 10 of the last 3 recessions. But I believe that this, my father was an economist and I am a historian, and this period of sort of pseudo-prosperity was building up for a long time and really causing problems that I think will take longer. I don't think we're going to come out of this in a year.
Yeah.
I think it will be a long period. It doesn't have to be as bad and deep as the Great Depression, but I do think that we will have to reshape and that we will reshape our values about family, about consumerism, about energy, and about what it takes to live the good life. And all we can hope is that people in communities, like the people listening to you, will try to reshape that in a way that moves us forward rather than gets us stuck in a blame cycle.
Hmm. And back here to that, Dr. Coleman, just real quick, and this may be, this question may hinge on the issue of resources, but if people are hesitant to, if they think they're having difficulty and they do have access to some kind of counseling and they're hesitant, what do you say?
Well, I think if you have access to it, this would be the time to use it. That most people don't use counseling, and I think everybody could benefit from counseling. But when you're in a period of a crisis, well, for example, people wait 6 years too long to get marriage counseling in the best of times. Well, this is not the best of times. So I strongly encourage people to get counseling. It doesn't make you sick or ill or weak to get help, and the research shows that people who actually reach out for support and get more support do better. It's good for you. It's good for your family. So that would be my strong advice.
All right. Well, there we'll have to leave it with our thanks to our guest, Joshua Coleman. He is a psychologist in private practice with offices in San Francisco and Oakland, California. He's a senior fellow with the Council on Contemporary Families, authored a number of books about marriage, The Marriage Makeover, Finding Happiness in Imperfect Harmony. That's one. And When Parents Hurt, Compassionate Strategies When You and Your Grown Child Don't Get Along. Dr. Coleman, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Stephanie Kuntz. She teaches history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She's director of research and public education for the Council on Contemporary Families. She's authored a number of books about families, including Marriage, a History, From Obedience to Intimacy, or How Love Conquered Marriage. And to you, Professor Kuntz, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And both of the guests have websites, and if you're interested in their work and to find out more about them, you'd go on the Internet and you look for them.